This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer. 'Tis the season to listen to some wonderful Christmas music. But did you know that much of it was written by composers who are Jewish? And it's also peak flu season, and there is actually some good news on the healthcare front. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Just as we head into peak holiday indulgence season, there's some not-so-new evidence on middle-aged weight creep and what to do about it. In midlife, adults often gain 1 to 2 pounds a year, and it can add up to around 20 pounds over a decade. That extra weight either appears as subcutaneous fat underneath the skin, which you can pinch, or the more dangerous visceral fat, which lies deep within the abdomen and is associated with several chronic conditions. Well, a new study from the University of Cambridge confirms what many of us already know, that improving diet and exercise is the most effective tool against middle-aged weight creep. Beloved children's author Robert Munsch shared more details about his dementia diagnosis and his choice of a medically assisted death, which he says is not imminent. The Love You Forever author was diagnosed with dementia in 2021 and now says he forgets words, falls down, and can't trust his own thinking anymore. However, he told the CBC that his publisher will continue to release books even after his death. He says he has about 50 previously unseen stories that are written, with one per year intended for release. A new study has found that a series of specialized computer-based training exercises can significantly reduce the risk of post-traumatic stress disorder among combat soldiers. Research from Tel Aviv University, Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and the National Institutes of Mental Health suggest an entirely new approach to treating PTSD using a cutting-edge computer program capable of alleviating symptoms by reducing fluctuations in attention toward and away from perceived threats. The research was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Disney theme parks may be dubbed the happiest places on earth, but recent changes to a popular program that lets disabled people skip the lines have come under fire from those who say the company has no right to determine who is disabled. Disney says changes had to be made since the program, which started in 2013, has grown from around 5% of guests to 20% in the last decade. The scope of the program now has been narrowed to guests who, due to a developmental disability like autism, have difficulty waiting in line. The British author behind the Shopaholic series of books has died at the age of 55. Madeleine Wickham, better known by her pen name Sophie Kinsella, revealed in 2024 that she had been diagnosed with glioblastoma, an aggressive form of brain cancer. Her first novel in the series, Confessions of a Shopaholic, introduced readers to Rebecca Bloomwood, a fictional financial journalist with an uncontrollable urge for retail consumption. That spawned 9 Shopaholic novels, which sold tens of millions of copies, were translated into dozens of languages, and made into 2 feature films. Her last novel, published in October 2024, entitled What Does It Feel Like? Mirrored her own experiences dealing with brain cancer. Kinsella is survived by her husband and 5 children. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. From Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to Winter Wonderland to sleigh bells, Christmas songs and their imagery have become a significant part of pop culture. But did you know that most of the most popular ones are the work of people who don't celebrate Christmas? Pianist and music lecturer Jordan Klapman tells us how the Jews wrote Christmas.
Jordan, you've tracked down a very interesting phenomenon that many people probably aren't aware of, but a huge proportion of the most popular Christmas songs were written by Jewish composers. Tell us about that.
That's correct. At least 15 of the top 25 secular Christmas songs of all time were written by certifiably Jewish composers. It's an amazing phenomenon.
What are some of those songs?
They're almost all of the biggies. Everything from White Christmas to Winter Wonderland, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Holly Jolly Christmas, Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree, The Christmas Song. It's an amazing list.
Wow. Okay, so let's get to the reasons. So why is it? It's a little strange when you think about it.
Well, it is and it isn't. It makes perfect sense when you hear the story. If you go back a few years, between 1880 and 1910, about 2 million Eastern European Jews emigrated from Tsarist Russia and Poland. And the vast majority of them tried to come to North America, and millions of them did make it to Ellis Island and to New York. And as a result, there were 2 million Jews living on the island of Manhattan by 1914. And they were crammed into a very tight and very, very small area, primarily the Lower East Side.
The Lower East Side.
That's right. They wanted to better themselves and the lives of their children. And the only way they could do this was by getting into industries where they had some kind of leverage. And the only industries they could get into that weren't controlled by a predominantly WASP establishment were the popular entertainment industries, which were considered undignified. And as a result of that, you have all of these Jewish kids and sometimes their parents moving uptown to what became the epicenter of the American popular entertainment industry. Vaudeville, the Broadway musicals, the Broadway theater, and the Tin Pan Alley songwriting factories. And that's where they were able to get a foot in the door.
But why Christmas?
Because they would write songs on any subject. And one of the largest demands in the mainstream market, because in order to make a really good living, you had to sell a mainstream song and not something marketed just to one particular ethnic group, they were called upon to write songs for Christmas, which was the big, big market.
Now, if you look at some of those songs, or most of those songs, they don't have any mention of Jesus Christ or anything more religious. Did that escape sort of the mainstream audience's notice, or?
No, actually, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. As the North American cultural experience became more and more secular and religion became less and less important in the mainstream, the reindeer and the snowmen and the Santas and all the Coca-Cola imagery and all of that other American pop culture influence became stronger and stronger. And as a result, there was less and less religious influence in the popular music, and there were less and less songs that were selling copies. And unfortunately, it really was a business decision. And more that were appealing more to a secular audience that seemed to capture what people wanted. And there weren't really any new hymns and carols really that became huge hits the way these popular songs were.
Do you draw any conclusion from all of this?
I think that the reason that the Jews got involved in writing the Christmas songs was because these songs appeal to very universal values. And all of the winter holidays, whether they be Diwali or whether they be Eid al-Fitr or Chinese New Year, they all have very, very common traditions. They're all about candles and light and little packets of money and sweets and comfort and family. And these are universal values. And it has nothing to do with where the holiday originated. They're all values that appeal to everyone. And I think the Jews realized that when they were writing these Christmas songs. And I think anyone who writes a Christmas song now that isn't parochial is going to have a much better chance of making more people feel included in what is now a very multicultural world in North America.
Okay, that's a good note to end things on. And happy holiday season, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, all of the above.
Thank you.
That was pianist and music lecturer Jordan Klapman. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, some good news about the shortage of family doctors. It is getting better.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
Finally, some good news on what is likely the biggest crisis in our healthcare system, the shortage of family doctors. A new study finds it's getting better. More Canadians have a family doctor or nurse practitioner now than 3 years ago. The bad news is, well, nearly 6 million people around the country still don't have a primary care point person. Dr. Tara Kieran is a family doctor and researcher, and she led this study as part of a project called Our Care.
You know, I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that things had improved to that degree. Our last survey was done in the fall of 2022, and that's when we estimated that about 6.5 million adults in Canada didn't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner. And our new survey, as you said, brings that estimate down to 5.9 million. But we have to remember that during that time, there was actually pretty substantial population growth within Canada. So it is a notable achievement that we have are going in the right direction, that we have reduced the number who don't have access to primary care. Now, of course, 5.9 million people who don't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner is still far too many, and there is more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the work, I mean, one of the things that I find very challenging, certainly here in Ontario, is that the government keeps doing things, but it's announced in dribs and drabs, and I just find it very hard to put it all together to see kind of where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is a really complex issue, people not having a family doctor. And so there are many tacks that governments need to take in order to address it. So maybe I'll just summarize some of what I know is happening here in Ontario and also in some other parts of the country. I mean, notably, I will say that in June of this past year, June 2025, the government actually passed a first of its kind legislation called the Primary Care Act. It basically lays primary care as the foundation of the healthcare system and then lays out six objectives for that system. And those six objectives, I should say, actually mirror concept for concept what we heard from people across the country they wanted to see in a better system. So we did a whole bunch of consultations in 2022, 23, and we actually put something together called the Our Care Standard that describes what every person in Canada should be able to expect from the primary care system. Things like everybody having a family doctor, having timely and ongoing care, care that's wellness-oriented, that's culturally safe, that's empowering to patients where people have their own records. And that's all actually enshrined in legislation now. And it includes the government reporting on its progress there. And so that's just one step that the Ontario government took. But I think it's actually a really important one because it clearly articulates the goal. Of course, this was after, in the fall of last year, about a year ago, they appointed Dr. Jane Philpott to lead a primary care action team. And they've committed by 2029 to have everybody attached to primary care and have committed more than 2.1 $1 billion in that effort. So some real investments specifically in team-based care. Of course, there's also been things like opening up of new medical school spots, more family medicine residency training spots, as well as fast-tracking international medical graduates to practice in Ontario. So lots of things going on.
Well, okay. So I have some questions about some of those notes. So for instance, in the health team that I'm part of, by the way, people, we have a medical panel every Wednesday. So we'll be talking more about this with our medical panel. But one of the doctors is on a health team and they got funding to expand the health team. So on their end, they had to make a commitment for 800 patients, and they've been trying to hire a nurse practitioner for months. And because of the shortages, they're having trouble.
Yeah, I mean, you're putting out a really good point. So first of all, great to hear that you're part of a health team. So in fact, actually only 25% of people in Ontario have that privilege. And I think part of the new reforms are to try and improve that and have everybody have access to that. Also great that we can see it in action, what's happening, new money being released and people raising their hand and saying, yes, I can take on more patients if I have more resources. But of course, the challenges is the health human resource shortages make that tricky. And so, I hear that your own doctor is having a hard time hiring a nurse practitioner. I think that perhaps we as a whole obviously have to hire more, but we also probably have to think about, are there other ways in which we can expand the number of patients doctors can see? Maybe it's more nurses or upskilling our clinical office assistants or having more social workers or pharmacists. So we have to use the resources we have while also training more people to be part of our healthcare system in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing you mentioned, Jane Philpott, and the commitment. Now, this was something that was flagged by the Auditor General just last week. And basically what she said is that people have to sign up through this Healthcare Connect, but people are not aware of Healthcare Connect. So any statistic based on placing people through Healthcare Connect is somewhat misleading.
It's true that Healthcare Connect has had its challenges for many years, and I think the government now has recognized that. That's why they made a commitment that as of looking at the list as of January 2025, they would clear everyone who had been on that list, whether that person had been on the list for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. Like, some of these people have been on it for a long time. And so there's a real commitment to clearing out that list by the spring of 2026. So let's watch to see what happens. And there also is a commitment to make that list more functional. Absolutely. If we really want people to use Healthcare Connect, we have to make sure that it's actually working and attaching people, which I think it's starting to do more and more. But we also have to ensure that we are advertising it very widely, including in multiple languages, because we know that there are many newcomers to Ontario who struggle with access. And so we can't just be relying on English, French website communication to get the word out.
Well, yeah, indeed. The irony is that the government, I mean, this is well beyond the scope of your study. The government spent millions of dollars, like for a Ronald Reagan ad with the U.S. media outlets, but has not spent a lot of money advertising something like Healthcare Connect that people actually here at home really need. But again, all of these, do you see these problems as kind of glitches to be worked through? Or would you say everything is kind of on the right track?
I do think we're in a very hopeful time, and I am very optimistic that we're going to see improvements. I mean, these improvements won't just come to be because we want them to. They take real hard work and persistent dedication from so many people behind the scenes. You know, I've heard Jane Philpott speak publicly, and I know how committed she is for example, to improving Healthcare Connect and clearing off that backlog. And I know she and the team are working really hard to do so. So that's just like an example of the really good people working hard behind the scenes to try and make things better. And they now, you know, we have more people dedicated to do that. We have more money to try and address the issue, at least here in Ontario. And so I actually do think Ontario is leading the way nationally when it comes to solutions. Of course, that's still very frustrating for the many people who don't have a family doctor or nurse practitioner right now. And we need to, you know, we need to do better when it comes to that. And I, in fairness to Dr. Jane Philpott, I've also heard her talk about how that's like really an urgent issue. And so that's why they're really trying to do things as quickly as possible, because they recognize how hard the current situation is for people.
I mean, again, one of the things is that even when people get attached, they end up being too far, or it's still hard to get in to see the doctor.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's important to note that our survey actually is very comprehensive. You know, we just talked about one of the many statistics and data points that we have in our survey. Our survey actually really tries to understand people's experiences of primary care in relation to the Our Care standard. So these are the six elements that people across Canada said were important to them when it comes to the primary care system. So yeah, we have some important data around timely access. We see that people, even who do have a family doctor or nurse practitioner, you know, it's a very few of them are able to get an appointment the same or next day when they have an urgent issue. Only a third said that they could get care outside Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. You know, it's less than 50% who said that they could get an appointment when their clinician was away. So those are pretty serious issues related to access that we need to address. But then there are also important other aspects that our, you know, survey points to. For example, you know, we want to make sure people know what to do. And, you know, only 22% of people said that they knew what to do if there was an issue related to the quality of care in that they were receiving in primary care. We also have some important data around access to health records. You know, we see that, you know, 25% of people didn't even know what health records were available to them online. And those who did know, you know, yes, they had access to things like lab reports, but very few had access to anything else.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, it sounds very comprehensive, and it's always good to hear some good news, even though it's possibly slow. Thank you so much, Dr. Tara Kieran.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. Tara Kieran, a family doctor and researcher who led the Our Care Project. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer, and thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Ziv Hadi, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.